The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Michael Lewis. Michael is the best-selling author of Liar's Poker, Moneyball, The Blind Side, Flash Boys, and The Big Short. His latest book is The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. Michael Lewis, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So last summer, my wife and I were part of an international improvisation symposium in California, and I was able to catch up with Aretha Sills. She's the granddaughter of Viola Spolin, who's considered the mother of improvisation, and she's the daughter of Paul Sills, who co-founded the Second City. And we were talking about the improv games her grandmother invented, and Aretha told me that originally Viola hadn't referred to them as games. She called them problems. And when I reread The Undoing Project in preparation for this conversation, your comment about Danny Kahneman really stuck out to me. You wrote of Danny, quote, "It was as if he structured the world around him so that it might be understood chiefly as a problem."
Yes. Well, and if you meet him, and I gather you have, when you're talking to him, you get the sense he's viewing you as a problem. It's just... He's interested in finding the question to answer, yeah. And he said, you know, once he said to his students in a seminar, it's something that's stuck in my head, and it's stuck in all their heads. And this is when he was a young professor. Mm-hmm. He said when he was at Hebrew University, and there were all these smart kids in his seminar, and everybody's competing to be the smartest one in the room, and shoot each other down and undermine each other and all the rest. And he said to them, "Listen. When someone in here says something, don't ask if it's true. Ask what it might be true of." Mm-hmm. In other words, don't tear it down, build it up. And figure out what kind of what the interest is in the thing. And I think he's moved through his whole life this way. That's how he copes with the world. I mean, I think it is a psychological state as much as it's a purely intellectual one. He looks at the world, and the way he's comfortable with it is by trying to understand the problem he's facing.
Right. And I want to dig much more into Danny and Amos Tversky, who are the sort of stars of this book. But I also, like, the reason you wrote it is compelling to me, and if the news that I read is true, it was about Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein's review of Moneyball that inspired the beginnings of this. Is that true?
Yes, in a funny way, the Undoing Project, which has improvisation woven through it, is in the very beginning an improvisational response. I had written Moneyball about the Oakland Athletics and their ability to win lots of games with no money. And the question that I thought I was answering is, you know, how do they do that? And how does it come to pass that baseball players can be so misunderstood that they can come in with new tools and new analytics and new data and find cheap ones and beat the teams that have lots of money? And how does it come to pass that a baseball player of all corporate employees is misvalued? And if a baseball player is misvalued, who can't be? And I never really asked in the book, like, why it happened. Like, no, it was clear that it happened, but why? And this review comes out after the book is published by Thaler and Sunstein, and they say, you know, Mr. Lewis doesn't seem to understand the point of his own story. And the point of his story is that he is giving a textbook case of the power of the work of Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who explored the mistakes the mind makes when it's making these intuitive judgments, like a baseball scout makes when he's staring at a baseball player trying to decide how good he is. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, Christ, I missed the story. And I ran to read Kahneman Tversky's work because I'd never really heard of them. Right. Maybe I'd heard of them, but only in passing. I didn't know it. And it occurred to me that I kind of had missed a story, a big part of the story, and that was this psychological research that had occurred in the late 60s and 70s and early 80s, that these two guys had they launched a field called judgment and decision-making, in which they had scientifically explored the behavior of the human mind. And they really did explain the mistakes that baseball scouts made when they looked at baseball players.
So the three-dimensional aspect of this that I love is in improvisation, we have a phrase called make mistakes work for you, which is the thing you did. You actually ended up, you know, launching into this other study and this other book. And as you and I were chatting before the podcast, too, we work with Richard Thaler, who's obsessed with sports, by the way, as you might know. And is constantly trying to get, like, football teams and baseball teams and other people to actually take his advice. They'll hire him to do all this sort of analytic research and then not follow ever any of his suggestions.
And the reason for that is, with some exceptions, when someone like Richard Thaler walks in and has a really good argument for doing something different, the argument might be understood and swallowed by the people in the professional football team or the professional baseball team or the professional basketball team, but they then face social ostracism if they do it.
Yeah.
So there's like this game theoretic thing going on that the sports themselves punish people who do things differently, even if it's smarter. And the problem is that what Richard Thaler cannot do is give people, he can tell them smarter ways to behave, but he can't give them foolproof recipes for success. So if you fail conventionally, not just in sports, but in many businesses, many aspects of life, if you fail, but you're doing things more or less how everybody else is doing it, the world forgives you. If you fail doing things really differently than the way everybody else in your industry is doing it, you might never recover.
Right.
And so I think that's the problem.
But you found a sports guy who seems like he's getting away from it, and this is a sort of a fun beginning story of the book, which is about the Houston Rockets GM, Daryl, do you pronounce it Morey?
Morey.
Yeah, Morey. So this is a guy who seems to have embraced the Thaler-like thinking, Kahneman and Tversky-like thinking, and applied it to a very successful basketball franchise.
So this conversation is going to get very incestuous very quickly, because what happened was Daryl Morey, the owner of the Houston Rockets, read Moneyball and said, Les Alexander, back in 2003, and said, I want somebody to come and do this for my basketball team. Hmm. And he went and found Daryl Morey, who was kind of having these radical thoughts about basketball, and actually empowered him to run his organization differently. But it required an owner who was willing to face social ostracism, and this guy was. He really was. He's pretty great. He was willing to do it. But most of there are a lot of owners who, when they say they want to do it differently, but the minute they do it differently and it doesn't pan out right away and they're made fun of in the local newspaper and so on and so forth, they fire the people they brought in to do it differently.
Right.
Witness Sam Hinkie at the Philadelphia 76ers.
Yep.
So the point of the story in the beginning of the Undoing Project, which is a story of Daryl Morey trying to figure out how to keep the mistakes the mind makes out of his office, like out of his process. And the mistakes that it makes is, you know, you have a really great free throw shooter who's a college player, like, say, Steph Curry, come into the gym to work out for you, and he happens to shoot 6 or 8 free throws, and he misses 3 of them. And all the scouts say, oh, he can't really shoot free throws. And they generalize from what they see. Or, and there's a really great example, that when the scouts are looking at players, and that they often compare the players, the amateur players, to players, professional players they've seen before. And the physical resemblance will actually screw up their judgment. So if you happen to look exactly like Michael Jordan, and you had a game that was kind of like Michael Jordan but really not so good, they may the scouts are much more likely to think you might be as good as Michael Jordan than if you didn't look like Michael Jordan. And so Daryl Morey, as a rule, he had in his draft room, when these scouts are banding about amateur players they might draft, he says, "You're not allowed to compare one player to another unless they're of different races."
Love
so
that.
You're not allowed to say that's the next Yao Ming, and that's the next if the guy is Chinese, or this is the next Michael Jordan if the guy is African American, or he's the next Kevin Love if the guy's a white guy. You have to make that imaginative leap. You can't just let your mind lazily kind of think in stereotypes.
When I read that, I was like, man, that should be part of every diversity training program in corporate America, because it's getting at some of the real problems, which are these heuristics and these biases that people have, and they have it across the board. The other thing that he outlawed, right, was nicknames.
Nicknames. So he was. They were early in his tenure in the Rockets. So this is a decade ago. Daryl had generated basically an algorithm for evaluating the amateur players, where you just looked at them based on their performance statistics. Now, this was not perfect, but he thought that it was sort of like a blind hiring policy. You weren't going to be distracted by how they looked, kind of thing. You were just going to say, how did they play? And his algorithm turned up a young Spanish player named Marc Gasol, who's the brother of an NBA superstar named Pau Gasol. Mm-hmm. But in the middle of talking about him, someone pulled up on the internet a picture of Marc Gasol with his shirt off, and he had boobs, like man boobs. Uh-huh. And they started calling him man boobs. And Daryl is absolutely sure that the reason they did not draft this guy is that constantly calling him by this derisive nickname lowered his value in everybody's mind, and they just kind of shunted him off to one side. And this guy is now, you know, he may or may not be a Hall of Famer,
yeah,
but he's close. And so from that moment on, Daryl said no more nicknames.
Yep. So, all right. So we have this very relatable story and very akin to kind of Moneyball, but with the shift in terms of the underlying scientific principles. But the book is about Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky. A little bit more on Kahneman. You noted the sort of important role of being distant, apart, and observant with regard to him. And I think for both of them, too, there was kind of an otherness to them. And it was funny because I was looking at sort of recent stuff that you had written or interviews you'd given, and I found one in the Financial Times where you say about yourself, well, you say you're temperamentally unsuited to politics because you're not a joiner. You see a crowd and you move the other way. Is there a connection there between you and maybe what attracted you to these guys?
Huh. Well, I never thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it is absolutely true that I do share in common with both of them a kind of dangerous loner characteristics.
Yeah.
I tell you what fueled my interest in this. Well, so just to briefly get back to Daryl Morey for a sec, that here is a person who is trying to expunge human intuition from his decision-making process, doing everything he possibly can to do that, and can't. And so he realizes we're stuck. We're going to live with our minds no matter what we do, and we're going to live with the mistakes the minds make. And what got me juiced about both Amos and Danny is one, they were the problem they were addressing was so profound,
mm-hmm,
and two, like everything that came out of their mouths or off their pens, in the case of Amos, was just interesting to me. It was just so different and original, and it was the kind of insights that you get from people who are not drawn to crowd thinking, who are kind of really like they aren't self-consciously thinking for themselves. They just kind of do it, and so that's what it just all felt so fresh to me, even though some of the stuff was, you know, 40 years old. So that's what got me going. And I did think, from very early on in the process to very right before I started writing the book, which is, so it was a kind of a 7-year research project. I did think all the way through, what business do I, Michael Lewis, have writing this book about these two intellectual giants? Right. I am not an intellectual giant. I didn't have any background in psychology. A lot of the book is set in Israel. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff I had to wade through was in Hebrew. I mean, I just felt no particular obvious connection to it. But every time I put the thing to one side, saying to myself, I have no business writing this book, I'd regret it. I'd sit there thinking, you know, this is the most interesting stuff I've ever run across. I've got to get back to it. It was just like what came out of their mouths.
Yeah. My wife has taught improvisation for 30 years, and she was the artistic director of the Second City Training Center for many years and built our comedy program with Columbia College. And when she read Thinking Fast and Slow, she basically came home and go, I found the Bible that connects to all of our work. And it really, like, you could, after reading that book, I imagine you could go back and map out all your other books using this thinking.
That's absolutely true. And I tell you what, apropos of Second City and improvisation, it was really clear very early on in the research into their relationship that the pixie dust, the secret sauce, the magic ingredient that was at the heart of their collaboration were the rules of improv comedy. Mm-hmm. That they didn't know them, but they obeyed them. And the two of them in a room together became very, very different characters than they were outside the room. Outside the room, they maintained their distance from the world around them. They were very, very critical of the world around them. But in the room, they were never critical of each other. They were always accepting and asking not is it true, but what might it be true of. And Danny Kahneman said to me that in the end, the reason the relationship fractured and the collaboration ended was that they started to become critical of each other. They started to do exactly the things people teach you not to do in a Second City workshop.
Right.
And so that interested me, that they had this, that the sort of like the key to the success of this of collaboration, and it wasn't a comic collaboration, it was a serious intellectual endeavor, were these an intuition that that's how you needed to behave.
Yeah, and we should note for our listeners that you've actually taken a Second City workshop, so you know of what you speak.
Well, and I took it. You know, it's funny. I didn't take it because I thought I wanted to take a Second City workshop. I had a 7 or 8 year old daughter whose first word out of her mouth when she got up in the morning was no, and the last word out of her mouth before she went to bed was no, and she was so negative to everything that anybody said to her. I thought I'm gonna educate her. I'm gonna take her to Second City, stick her in a workshop, and teach her how to be teach her yes and
yeah. The
beauty of kind of like accepting and building on things. And so we flew out there, and she went into the kids program, and I, with nothing better to do, went into the grown-ups program. And after about the four-hour morning session, we came out, and I had actually sweated through my shirt. It was
Wow. It
was so hard for me. I was so anxious the whole time. It was so difficult and unnatural to me. Mm-hmm. And I thought of myself as this great, like, it would just come naturally to me because I kind of, I go with the flow kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was horrible. And although educational, and she came bouncing out and said, "This is so easy and so much fun."
Oh, that's so funny! Did you find that you freed up the more you did it?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I found I was not the natural at it that I imagined I would be,
right.
And that I was actually I was a weak performer, mm-hmm. and that shocked me. I thought it was going to come very easily to me, but I also found that the more I did it, the easier it became, and the more fun it became. But the big thing was, you know, when you sit in one of those workshops for a couple of days, and you're forcing yourself to obey the rules of improvisation, and you come back out on the street your behavior is different.
Totally.
And you start to see how it kind of lights up your life if you take those, if you kind of pretend you're in an improvisational comedy skit when you're going through your life.
So and this is exactly what ties together everything we're talking about, because and I don't know that these things are connected, but you know, the improv stuff that was created, the games in the 20s and 30s, but really at the University of Chicago in the late 50s, mid 50s, late 50s, you know, these rules are all nudges. What we're talking about, the sort of radical thinking in behavioral economics, is that people behave irrationally. And prior to these guys, that was not, you know, how things were done. And improvisation does the exact same thing. It goes, you don't want to work. You're going to say no. So we're going to make you say yes. And you're going to be so afraid of failure. We're going to make it okay to fail. In fact, we're going to fail a bunch. And so indeed, the idea there is that you can't, if you take these things off the stage and into your life, you are going to be walking around with nudges that can make you more successful in working with other people. And I loved a thing that you quoted. I think Amos said that people are not so complicated. It's relationships between people that are complicated.
Yes. And he said, in no relationship, mine is more complicated than my relationship with Danny.
Yeah.
Everything you say, you just said, totally resonates with me. And what I can't figure out is, knowing all this, like knowing how actually happiness-inducing it is to walk around obeying the basic, you know, looking people in the eye, smiling, responding, trying to figure out what someone said and building on it, all that, just in your daily life, how useful, helpful, interesting, happy-making that is. Why I am forever lapsing back into any other state of mind. I mean, it's like, why are people so wired not to be improvisational comedians?
Yeah, well, and we can talk about why. So there's these heuristics, a term I didn't know until I started researching this work. And we don't have to go through all of them, but I think it would be kind of cool to talk about a couple of them so people can get
sure.
The idea. One is availability heuristic.
Right.
And that this is one that certainly, you know, can be referenced in Daryl's Houston Rocket story. It's in business all the time. I pulled this quote. We have a kind of stereotype of randomness that differs from true randomness. Our stereotype of randomness lacks the clusters and patterns that occur in true random sequences. Let's unpack that a little bit.
Well, you just jumped from availability to what they call representativeness.
Yes, yeah.
So let's start with availability.
Yeah.
Let's back up one sec. What they were doing was they were essentially giving people little statistics tests without people knowing they were taking a statistics test when they were studying this. And they were saying, all right, we're going to give people problems to which there's actually a statistically correct answer. And, of course, we're not expecting people to do the statistics. We're just trying to figure out what they're doing when they're not doing the statistics. Like, what are they doing that leads them to the wrong answer when they systematically get the wrong answer?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they're doing is they're being overly driven by whatever leaps to mind. So vivid things, recent things, memorable things distort judgment. So a simple example, like when you're driving down the highway at 80 miles an hour, you are making, whether you know it or not, a probabilistic calculation of the likelihood you're going to die on that highway.
Right.
You're saying, oh, it's pretty low. You know, I'm moving fast. I'm a good driver. The weather's good, so on and so forth. And then you see a gnarly traffic accident and ambulances and bodies on the road and traffic slows down. And for the rest of the day, you are not driving 80 miles an hour. You're making a different calculation. You're essentially saying, oh, I'm much more likely to die on the road, and so I'm going to go slower. Now, the truth is that after a big accident that everybody's seen, everybody's driving more safely, and you're probably less likely to get in an accident going 80 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But your judgment has been distorted by what's available, by what you just saw. So we're always responding to the last crisis. When a hurricane hits New Orleans, everybody thinks the hurricane's the next thing that's going to happen. When an earthquake hits California, everybody's worried about earthquakes, when they should be worried about them before they happen.
Right. Yeah.
Now they said that's one thing that distorts judgment. It's like how the tricks of memory, like why we remember some things. Our memory distorts our sense of true probabilities. The second thing they said is that we think in stereotypes, that we have that we think in classifications, and so Daryl Morey will tell you here's a really great example from basketball. When a player who is doesn't look like a superstar player shows up, Steph Curry, and they can't file him in any stereotype. He's always undervalued. Mm. And when a player looks like some famous player, he's overvalued. In my life, I have actually internalized this. Whenever I'm going to hire anybody for a job, whether it be a doctor to fix my hip or a nanny to take care of my children or a research assistant, I'm always wary about hiring the person who looks the part. Mm. Because the person who looks the part is less likely. The person who doesn't look the part and is in the role is more likely to actually be good at it, because the reason they're in the role is they're good at it rather than they look the part. Mm. And so they got at that with a third heuristic that they had fun with. They called anchoring. And anchoring was just the ability of any unrelated piece of information thrown up in front of a problem to distort your answer to the problem. And this will give you a flavor of sort of how they did their research. They built a wheel of fortune in their office with the numbers on it were 0 to 99. And they'd have subjects come in and spin the wheel of fortune, and it would land on a number. And after it landed on a number, they would ask the subject, what's the percentage of countries in the United Nations that come from Africa? And if someone had spun a high number, they systematically gave a higher estimation of the number of countries in the United Nations that came from Africa. That you could, just by throwing a number out front that had nothing to do with the question you were going to ask, you could distort people's answer to the question.
This should be unsettling. I mean, it's fascinating and unsettling, because what you realize is, you know, we're all telling stories to ourselves to make sense of the world, and those stories are likely not true. In one way, it's amazing we're not all crashing into each other on the street.
Well, they would say.
Uh-huh.
You're right. We're telling stories instead of making calculations, when sometimes we should be making calculations. Mm-hmm. And the stories, it's not that the stories are always wrong. It's just, it's predictable the directions in which they'll be wrong.
Right.
That we as a species make these systematic errors. And, you know, you say it's a wonder we're not all crashing into each other, but a million people on the planet die every year in automobile accidents.
Yeah, I guess we are.
You know, one day we're not going to be allowed to drive, and people can understand why.
Yeah.
But it's so that we are all crashing into each other.
Yeah. Okay. Good point. I'm curious and I'm going to soon ask you for a yes and story, but I'm curious at the title of this book. Did you have a hard time getting to the title, or did it just appear to you right away?
It came in a flash when I was going through Amos Tversky's files. Amos had died in 1996, and my way of getting at him was through memories of others, and he left behind some papers. And he and Danny, or Danny Rather, at the end of their relationship, got very frustrated and angry because he thought he was having ideas and saying things, proposing things to Amos, and Amos was just dismissing them critically and not listening or paying any attention. This was what killed the collaboration. And Danny thought he wanted to work on was Danny thought of it as studying the rules of the human imagination. And what had triggered his interest was he had had a nephew who was a fighter pilot in the Israeli Air Force, who had been killed in a crash the day before he was due to be released from the Air Force. He'd been in for like 5 years. Mm-hmm. And Danny had gone back to the funeral, and being Danny, he kind of stood apart. Instead of grieving, even though he loved the guy, he kind of stood back and watched how other people grieved. And he noticed that a lot of people were uttering what amounted to if-only statements. If only he'd gotten out a day earlier. If only they hadn't shot that flare up in front of the plane. The kid had actually thought he was going up when he was actually flying down, and he had flown his plane into the ground. Mm. If only this, if only that. And Danny thought to himself, well, that's strange because, you know, there are a million different, there are an infinite number of if-only statements you could form and still have the boy live. If only Israel hadn't had an Air Force. Right. If only he'd been born a girl. But nobody did that. He said there are rules to the way people are undoing this tragedy. Mm. And one of the rules he sensed was they start with the event and work backwards and change the first thing they can change and have it all go away. If only James Comey had not been mucking about with Hillary Clinton's emails right before the election. Right. You know, that's what people do. If only the field goal kicker had not missed the kick at three seconds left in the game. They don't go back and say if only the lineman hadn't held in the first quarter. And so he came back to Amos with this and wrote him long letters. And as far as he knew, they went into a drawer and never came out again. Hmm. And in Amos's filing cabinet, I found this folder, and it was labeled The Undoing Project. And my God, if Amos hadn't spent days noodling on this, and he was trying to kind of formalize Danny's thinking in mathematical equations, he was obviously interested in it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, when I saw that, I thought, one, I love the phrase, The Undoing Project. Yeah. It was the thing that killed their relationship and caused it to come undone. But I thought, it's actually kind of a description of their whole body of work, because they were busily undoing false theories of how people, what make people tick, how they work. And that was kind of the through line in their work. They found theories of human nature, human behavior, and showed how they were false. And so when I saw it, I thought, that's my title.
Yeah, that's yeah. It works on all those different levels. Okay, I could talk to you forever, but we always end the podcast by asking our guests for a yes and story. So sometime in their life, an action that where they normally would have said no, but instead they only said yes, they said yes and. Do you have one of those stories for us?
It's not a funny one, but I have, you know, I'm sure if I racked my brain, I'd have a lot of them. But this is well before I would ever have known of Second City or improv comedy. It may even be before Second City existed. I was maybe 13, 14 years old. I was sent to a sports summer day camp by my parents because I was just sitting on my ass all summer. And I was 13, and I was a very truculent 13-year-old. When I was 14, my mother looked at me and said, "You know," in a really cool tone, she said, "You know, for 7 years you've made my life sheer hell." And I thought to myself, "Yeah, that's great. I've been trying to do that." Mm-hmm. I love my mother, and we're all good now. But back then we weren't, and so she sent me off to this summer day camp, and I continued my truculent ways there, and I was a good athlete, and I got into my group, which became a team, and a lot of the kids weren't any good, and I got frustrated with them, and I was pissy with them, and like ordering people around and this and that. And the counselor turned to me, and he said something like, "Are you always such a joy to be with? Is this like especially good day for you?" And he said, "You know, we were playing a football game, and I was a quarterback." He said, "Sit out. You're not even playing anymore." Mm-hmm. And I normally would have just flipped on him, and just shut down. But I went and sat down, and I thought, you know, he's right. It's absolutely right that I have been completely uncooperative with the group of people I've been assigned to be with. And I went up to him, and I apologized, something I seldom do, but should do more, mm-hmm. and said, "And don't put me in a glamour position. I'll just be the blocker. I'll just block for people." Mm-hmm. And embraced that role, and it was one of the more memorable 3 or 4 week stretch of my life. What happened after that? I have a, my wife has a picture. She kind of arbitrarily plucked over her desk, and it's a picture of me sitting in a group of teenagers. I was kind of on the young end of the camp, holding this giant best camper trophy, which they gave me at the end of the camp. And it was just because they kind of turned me into a nice person. And the way they did it was by, first kind of giving me this little talk, but my response to it was, okay, I'm gonna change and see what happens. So I vividly remember that. I lapsed back into jerk very easily, but I do remember it, and I can sometimes, in the same way, kick myself out of the jerk state at age 13. I can do it even now at age 57.
I love that. I was just reading Daniel Coyne's new book, The Culture Code, and he's got a story about Joe Madden. I don't know if you've heard this. He's the coach for the Cubs. Where Madden has a glass bowl on his desk, and in it are slips of white paper with an expensive wine written on it. And so if you break a team rule, you have to pick one of the slips of paper out. You have to go buy that wine. But then the key is you have to come back, uncork it, and drink it with Joe Madden. Isn't that great?
That's pretty great.
And it's this idea of the punishment is also connected to the reconciliation. And it sounds like a little bit like you had to get your ass kicked a little bit or humiliated, but you had the change, and then they brought you back into the sort of bosom of the group.
It's funny. It is completely true that you people at Second City get so used to living by your rules that they're second nature.
Yeah.
But they're not first nature.
No.
And it is amazing how often I have to relearn the basic tricks to moving through the world happily.
Yep.
And this kind of be quick to apologize, quick to not be afraid of failure, like almost embrace it. Quick to just try to see what was good and what just happened, rather than what was bad. All those things they're so useful. But what I can't figure out is why, if they're so useful, do I keep forgetting them?
Yeah, well, I think it's practice, right? I mean, we don't practice our living, and improvisation is essentially practice in being unpracticed. We've all tried to find, why have so many famous people come out of Second City from 1959 to now when it's not like the same casting director? And the only thing I can attribute it to is that they're so deeply practiced in this work, it's deliberate practice, right? In front of audiences, that they are like superhuman when they go out into the world. But they never stop. This is the other thing about Second City people, is they never stop improvising. So all those people who are on their show, the shows that they're on, they usually end up going by whatever improv house, whatever town they're in, to do some sets. They've got to keep their muscles up because, it'll atrophy.
It does atrophy. It is like a muscle. That's absolutely right.
Michael Lewis, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down, working in a coal mine.